So I never had the pleasure of meeting Brian Vickery, although I had a blog conversation with him. He turned up on my taxonomy blog one day, so we had a slight interaction then. And that's how I discovered his paper on knowledge organization, which he only put on his personal website. This is a quote from it. And I had sort of mixed feelings about putting this up because I proposed to pick a fight with him, and it's not very fair to pick a fight with somebody who's not in a position to reply. And I also feel quite regretful about it because I think it would have made an interesting conversation from what I know about him, from the things that people have said about him, that there would have been some very interesting and searching questions and a great conversation out of the fight. But I'm trusting that those of you who knew him well will be able to represent him. please feel free to interrupt if you feel outraged or moved. It is a subject that I'm looking at the conduct of science, and I'm really interested in, are we worthwhile as a profession? And actually, Graham asked a smaller version of that question yesterday when he said, is this useful? If we look at Faraday's relational indexing, is this useful? So are we useful is the bigger question. So the fight I want to pick is this statement in that paper on knowledge organization. Knowledge organization is the work of scholars and encyclopedists. It is not the role of the information profession. And I think that is no longer true. I don't think we can afford that to be true. I think there are two assumptions embedded inside that statement. The first is that there is a distinction, a boundary, between scholars and information professionals, and that we keep our distance from each other. We know where the boundary is. We don't get mixed up in each other's work. And the second is that the work of knowledge organization, the work that we do, is primarily around search and discovery, or should be. I mean, it has been, but should it be? So the context for this paper and most of the content of the paper in the proceedings, the sort of the detailed argument, comes out of some work that I've been doing with the National Science Foundation in the US. National Science Foundation, one of its remits is to track the activity of science in the United States, and they give a report to Congress on what is happening in science and technology in terms of investment, in terms of outputs, in terms of activity, in terms of jobs, in terms of industry, in terms of economic impact. And most of the activity that they do around that is survey-driven. So they send these surveys, questionnaires to universities, to businesses, to administrators, to scientists, to graduate students. And many of the issues around trying to understand the whole picture of what's happening in science and technology in the United States and the kind of economic impact is how they connect the languages that the researchers speak about what they're doing and the languages that the university administrators speak, who are often not close to the research that the university is actually doing, how investments are allocated. Very often it's, you know, somebody in the finance department sort of figures out, it's probably about 20% to this and 30% to that. And increasingly, most of the impactful science, most of the interesting science, the new knowledge creation, is, to borrow Christine's word, intersectional. Most of the interesting science is between disciplines or combinations of disciplines, which is why part two of the ISO standard is really important, and compound concepts are really important. Now that's relevant to us because most of what we've done for the last 150 years, at least, has been what's in the middle of a discipline, not intersectional stuff. So actually, I think Christine's paper should have been a main presentation in this conference, because that's where most of the interesting innovations in the conduct of science, at least, and social science, is happening. What society needs is at the boundaries of what we're good at, not in the middle of what we're good at. So if we look at science as a successful enterprise, it needs three things. It needs consistent ways of describing activities of science. Because if we don't have consistent ways, scientists from adjacent or intersecting disciplines can't talk to each other. They can't coordinate their activities. The second is we need a way of getting a view across domains so that different aspects of science can be combined and put together in interesting and useful ways. And the third is, we need to be able to, you know, there's that famous Newton quote, standing on the shoulders of giants. Well, we need to understand the language of the giants in order to create new knowledge. And so being able to carry concepts through time and understand what people were doing in the past related to what we're doing now and create new knowledge and new language into the future. This is a statement from a report on a federal government working group on digital data, which I think is actually an extremely good kind of vision statement for what we should be doing in knowledge organization. The ability to achieve innovation in a competitive global information society hinges on the capability to swiftly and reliably find. Okay, we're comfortable here, right? This is all foreign territory to us, the rest of it. Understand, share, apply complex information from widely distributed sources for discovery, progress, and productivity. Without discovery, progress, and productivity, finding is irrelevant. In fact, we don't even know what this means. Catherine made a very interesting statement yesterday. Facet analysis is a problem for us. How do we do it? Well, it's only a problem for us if we do not understand the context for which facets are used. So to me, Marianne's paper yesterday on the general practitioners. Facet analysis for the general practitioners, is my guess, was not a problem in that project. Because understanding who the users were, understanding the typical tasks that they needed to fulfill, their purpose, what they wanted to do, what they needed to do, what they were motivated to do, makes the facets visible to the analyst. You understand why you're making the facets. So finding doesn't make sense by itself. That's why the boundary that we have, very neat boundary that we have between this stuff and all of this, doesn't work anymore. We need to understand the contours of the community and the way that they work and the problems that they're interested in. So we need to get really deeply involved in understanding what they're doing and why they're doing it and the kinds of information that they're working with, which I think is similar to what Liz was saying just now, is about the interaction between the information designers and the people they are designing for. Let me summarize what I think, why I think knowledge organization systems and knowledge organizing work has something to offer to what the conduct of science needs. The first is it supports that coordinating function, because one of the key things that we do is we standardize language. We're very good at standardizing language for other people. Clearly, from yesterday, we know this already, we're extremely bad at standardizing language for ourselves. We create structures, and the structures show interesting and important relationships and connections between concepts. So the structure itself carries meaning and carries the potential for new meaning, new insight. And the third thing, very important, the reason for the existence of the knowledge organization system is all of the rest of those things in that statement by the Digital Working Group, which is it enables sense-making. And sense-making enables productivity, discovery, new knowledge creation, innovation, and so on. And I was really pleased to see in Amanda's information behavior model, you have sense-making and you have all of those reasons for doing the information-seeking behavior. There's always a reason for information organization, information behavior. And having that sharp boundary between the standardization of language and structuring relationships, and then the reason for being, which is the sense-making and decision-making and acting and so on, just doesn't work for us anymore. We kind of got away with it because the information environments we were working with were relatively predictable, relatively stable, and relatively structured. We were dealing with published content which has been through a refining process. We were dealing with, you know, manageable populations and manageable types of information interaction. That's no longer true. A couple of examples, very quick examples, for how knowledge organization in science has enabled leaps forward in science. So Linnaeus, if we think about his binomial naming system, he was standardizing language. If we think about the way that he developed his taxonomies, he created structures which were highly salient for, actually highly predictive of where biological science was going. He preceded evolutionary theory, but his structures actually predicted quite well, or worked very well with the development of evolutionary theory. His standardization of language meant that people could compare observations, and that meant that biological knowledge grew rapidly. Mendeleev, the periodic table, is a very good illustration of a taxonomical structure. It's a matrix, not a hierarchy. It's a taxonomical structure which illustrates a very key sort of sense-making capability, which is it identifies gaps. So he has his matrix, and they pour all of the known elements into this matrix. And then you see that there are gaps where there are elements that you don't know. So then you can say, okay, there's a gap there. Does that element exist? Scientists go looking for it, and they find it. And if they can't find it, they make it. So the key thing about structures in knowledge organization is, are they salient, and do they give you predictive power? If they do, they will live. They will be useful. They will be productive. If we take sense-making, the sense-making function, out of the equation, we don't get that. You'll all be familiar with this sort of idea. We saw some versions of the sort of the hierarchy. I think it's less of a hierarchy, actually, of orders of complexity, and more of an ecosystem of orders of complexity. We are a little bit in love with hierarchies. You've got lists, you've got controlled vocabularies, you've got some structures in sort of taxonomies, and you've got ontologies as another order of complexity. The reason why ontologies are out there and floating around, people are getting argumentative about things. People get argumentative things about things because they matter, not because they're argumentative. Well, okay, some people will be argumentative just because they're argumentative, but usually it's because there's a social drive to understand this thing and to use this kind of thing. And when you have variation of language about something and people arguing about the variation of language, it's because it's not fully understood yet, but everybody knows that there's something there that they need, or we need collectively. So I think there are three key orders of complexities. There's the control of vocabulary, there's the taxonomies, there's the ontologies. I think the thing about ontologies is that they enable large-scale machine processing of content, of information. Ontologies are not designed for humans. I think the key insight from the last 20 years or so is that taxonomies, which we've always seen as being the highest order, in our profession, as the highest order of information organization, is now superseded by ontologies because of the scale of the information, the diversity of the information environment, and the demands on the information environment that comes from our society, different communities within society. Taxonomies increasingly, I think, are kind of focusing on designed human interfaces into a complex information environment. Designed human interfaces, meaning they're for particular communities looking at particular types of information or perspectives on information. So I think there's another connection there with what Liz was talking about a little bit earlier. And I think there's another mechanism which is emerging, which is really an observation of what was happening with this new National Science Foundation project, which is it's not enough to describe the information environment, because the information environment is continually shifting. And if you're thinking about the conduct of science, you're thinking about new knowledge creation and new language creation, new concepts emerging, and then relating back into the known. So we also need mechanisms for collecting and visualizing emerging language and emerging concepts. Examples are folksonomies and topic maps. And this, if you think about the conduct of science, it's about being at the borders of what we know and looking into what we don't know. Which again is why I think Christine's paper is very interesting. Because when she's talking about intersectionality, she's talking about things that are not within the core taxonomical or knowledge organization structures, the known, the well understood. She's talking about what happens in folksonomies. Can you see things that are not there in the official, formal knowledge organization systems? Where are the differences? What is marginal? The marginal stuff is the stuff that's interesting. In science, the marginal stuff is interesting because it's emerging. Science policymakers and science funders want to know what's happening at the margins, and they want to be able to guess where the best bets are for large-scale investment. It's not the core. I think the question that you are, the insight that you had yesterday around Faraday's relational indexing, that model, the whole intent behind that model, or the whole philosophy behind that model, was that the world is precisely describable. We know that it isn't now. Most people do, actually. I better not make a remark about some ontologists. We know that it isn't. What was interesting about your presentation yesterday was that you took that model, you applied it, and you discover that it can show you the boundaries between what is known and well understood and what isn't. The fact that it will highlight areas of uncertainty and ambiguity if you apply it in a certain way. And I think that's the sort of thing that we should be working with in knowledge organization systems, and that's where these mechanisms help. They help to highlight the marginal stuff. So here's some assertions. I will make them baldly and boldly, and there's sort of some substantiation in the paper in the proceedings. The first is that the complexity of knowledge organization system needs to match the complexity of the information environment and the communities that use it, which is why we cannot ignore ontologies. The second is when the complexity of the knowledge organization system exceeds our human cognitive abilities, our ability, attention span, how many things we can focus on at one time, how many things we can discriminate, how many things we can keep in working memory, which is what ontologies typically do. We need designed interfaces that are customized for our particular types of needs. So particular communities with particular types of needs, particular contours of knowledge landscape, we need interfaces that are designed to show us the salient things, the structures that are relevant to us as a community. And that's where taxonomy work should be pitched, I think. The third thing is that although semantic technology has great potential, it only describes. It only has descriptive power. And I got this insight at this National Science Foundation workshop where the earlier version of draft of this paper was developed for. It was conduct of science in the information age, but most of it was about data. It was all these scientists talking about large-scale data and the opportunities and the challenges of what you could do with all of this data if you could just combine it and look across it. The stuff that we were hearing about yesterday from the UK Data Archive. Once you have a knowledge organization system in place, you can relate all of these pieces. Again, why part two of the ISO standard is very important. Waiting for it with bated breath. Once you can connect concepts across large data collections, you start to get new insight. So there was a Science magazine article back in February talking about meta-knowledge, how you can track knowledge claims across data collections. And you can see patterns, and you can track it across different types of data collection. Structured data, less structured data, publications, outputs of science, collaboration activity of scientists, and so on. So none of that can be completely captured by semantic technology, because semantic technology only works on describing what is happening and visualizing what happens in texts. So that's why principle four is important. If you look at how the conduct of science has been traditionally measured and how we ourselves, information professionals, track it and organize it, we look at published content. We look at text. Well, actually, if you look at the work of important scientists who are really pushing the boundaries in the 21st century, some of them are administrators, they're scientists, they're administrators of large-scale scientific installations like the CERN accelerator. They're not publishing stuff. If you look at mid to late career successful scientists, their publishing activity is not a good index of their importance for science. It's which panels they sit on. Which European panels on the future of science and where money should be invested and all of those things. And it's the informal networks, the stuff that is invisible to the formal literature of science, which is what we've traditionally covered. So that's why principle four is important. And the most accessible way of being able to do that now is looking at the open science initiatives, the blogging, the wikis, the tweets, that sort of informal activity which is not structured in the way that we're accustomed to. So the ability to work with folksonomies, and again, Christian, the understanding what insights you can gain, not just from within social tagging systems, but also contrasting what is happening, what you see in social tagging systems that you don't see in the formal knowledge organization systems. And how can you learn from what's emerging in the social tagging systems that you can bring into the formal knowledge systems, understanding the different paces, slow science, fast science, and so on. And the fifth one is really about the need to have an ecosystem approach. It is not simply about, I need a controlled vocabulary for this, and I need a taxonomy structure for this. I need an ontology for this. We need a sense of an ecosystem of these different things working for different purposes, different communities using the same information set of information collection, same sort of information pool for different purposes at different times. The analogy that we've been working with, the metaphor, is the sort of the idea of the street, the department store, and the warehouse. So if you think about what happens in terms of information behavior on the street, socially, what we see on the street informs us about what is current, what is happening in the world, you know, what's hot, what's not, what are people wearing, what's in the shop windows, what's in the newspapers. And the sort of social media space on the web is a good representation of the street, blogging, tweets, microblogging, wikis, and so on. Fast knowledge, fast moving, a lot of it transient, some of it will stick. The department store is designed arrangements of content for economic purposes, right? A lot of work goes into arranging stuff in department stores so that they can sell the stuff. It's not arranged at random. And any good department store is a lesson in taxonomy building, because if the taxonomy doesn't work, they go out of business. They want people to find stuff according to purposes and according to, you know, discovering related things. The warehouse is organizing stuff for administrative purposes and logistic purposes. So I'm going to organize this because in such a way that I can easily restock it, I can supply it to the different department stores, and I've got simple ways of finding it and storing it that are suitable to the content, not to the users. Most of what we've been good at over the last 150 years has been in warehouse design, which again is why the work that you're doing in information behavior and the whole psychological, cognitive side, behavioral side of information seeking is so important, because that's where the department store is. We need to build our capabilities in the department store front, and we need to be much more active on the street than we have been traditionally. I wanted to make just a couple of remarks. You know, why is this relevant to us as a profession? And I started with that question, you know, why are we useful? How useful are we? I suppose this is a little bit outrageous, but I think the only thing that we've given to the 21st century is facets. And I think we are still trying to describe facet theory in irrelevant ways. So that when people come, they get interested in facets and they find out that, you know, we invented them. They come and ask us about them and we sort of give them this gobbledygook. Which is not relevant to the content and the communities. It's a strange language. It doesn't fit the context in which facets are now relevant and useful and important. Because a lot of the facet theory that we built was built around predictable, structured, bounded collections of content for reasonably well-defined community needs. And the reason why facets are important now is because we have unbounded, unstructured, extremely diverse demands on the information collections we have. So I think we need to rethink. I think we need to break a lot of what we've learned. I don't mean throw it away. I mean, the approach you took yesterday, I thought your paper, Grant, was fascinating, because it's exactly that kind of question we should be asking. Let's take something and let's see if it can be useful in another context. Will it give us a new frame for relating to real needs and real uses? So I think we are... you said this, Amanda, when you were talking about we need to get into this field quickly, otherwise the turf will be stolen. We are currently popular and much busier than I remember we were. And we are relevant at the moment. The last 10 years or so, we've been increasingly relevant as a professional to the outside world, beyond the library space. I think we're at risk of losing that relevance because we are not innovating. Some people are innovating. I don't think as a profession as a whole we're not innovating. We're not educated. We're not. You know, that house model you had is essentially a research agenda in which there is very little activity. There needs to be a lot more. So I think this is either a very exciting time for us or a very depressing one. And you can choose which one you want to be in. Thank you.
One of the worst jobs of being a chairman is to be a killjoy and cut things short. So I'm going to just take a couple of questions and ask you for five questions, all talk at once. Who went first? That, I think, at the lady at the back.
I enjoyed it very much, Patrick. Thank you for a lovely presentation, and I particularly like your metaphor of the house, or the warehouse, the house, and the street. I work for a large global organization, and that's what I help build, houses and warehouses. But, and I'm being very optimistic here, the trend that's happening now within my organization is that because I'm the one who understands data most, they're now asking me, well, what do we do in this town? What can we do here? And now I'm at the place to be able to say, well, go buy a kite at the store, take it over to the park, you know, buy an ice cream, and give them an immersive convergence of what data can be. Do you find that in your consultancy, this trend is also coming to you? We have all this data, Patrick. What can you do with it?
I think once you have salient knowledge organization structures in place, by salient, I mean, turns out, like Linnaeus's structure, turns out that they are useful and they predict, or they help you find new knowledge, help you do new things. Which is, again, going back to the UK data archive work. Once you start putting shape across the collections in place, you can start to look for opportunities. You can start to see opportunities. I think the problem for us as a profession is that it's not that this sort of innovation is not happening, but it's happening in pockets. It's gifted individuals doing interesting work. But as a profession, we're not incorporating and sharing and building on that knowledge, which is why I wanted to challenge yesterday the idea that we're a mongrel field and that we just take other disciplines and theories and use them. That is true to an extent, but unless we have a strategic view of who we are and what we do and what our core body of theory is, we don't know how to deploy and use people's experience or other theories to advantage. We're very tactical as a profession. We need to become more strategic. Maybe it's a different answer to the question.
Currently in knowledge organization, we have an important, maybe dominant paradigm called domain analysis, which recommends to build knowledge organization systems starting from looking at how communities within a domain organize their knowledge. So in a sense, this is close to your interest with getting close to scientists, which is one kind of community. But in the other sense, this seems to be against your interest for interdisciplinarity across domains, which I personally subscribe. So I would be curious, what do you think about this domain analysis paradigm?
I think there is a tension between those two things, and that's why I think this is either an extremely exciting time to be in or an extremely intimidating and depressing time to be in, because the demands on us are so great. I thought the paper that you gave yesterday on looking at the three language communities around information retrieval was a tour de force, and it's something that we need within... But that's just information retrieval, just understanding the different communities around information retrieval. And now we're talking about, okay, if you're doing taxonomies and knowledge organization systems to support the conduct of science, you have to essentially become part scientist. You have to immerse yourself in that as well, which is why the question of the information professions comes into play, because no individuals can do this. We can't all suddenly become Renaissance people where we can cover all of the skills and abilities, which is why we need to break the way that we educate ourselves and develop ourselves and reform it, and why we need to build a shape for where we want to be as a profession or as a group of professions, and take a strategic view of where we want to go. Because without that, we don't know how to connect all of the skills and abilities and technical abilities that we need to do in order to be useful. This is a large-scale problem. Now, it's the same problem in conduct of science as a whole. Very little science now is done by lone scientists or single research teams. It's large-scale collaborations across multiple countries and institutions and infrastructures. So this is not something that we are alone in facing. It is possible to do. But we need to be talking to... And conferences like this are so important.
My apologies to you and specifically to Patrick, but I'm going to cut it short now because we are running over time. Thank you very much indeed, all three speakers.